Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nora Ami, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. Lessons for Survival, Mothering Against the Apocalypse, by Emily Rabiteau. Emily Rabiteau's Lessons for Survival, Mothering Against the Apocalypse, opens with a touch of twisted wit. Pregnant with her first child and on the way to her baby shower, she glimpses a chalk message on a sidewalk sandwich board. The end of the world is nigh. The moment, an announcement of impending death colliding with a celebration of imminent birth, encapsulates the tensions that propel Rabiteau's book, a soulful exploration of the fraught experience of caretaking through crisis. Across 20 essays, many illustrated with her arresting photos of murals and other public art around New York City, she considers a trio of calamities: climate change, racially motivated police violence, and the COVID-19 pandemic. Compounding these problems for Rabiteau are developments both political and personal, including Donald Trump's election to the presidency in 2016, her trials with sexual harassment and abuse, chronic pain, and the death of her father, the great historian of religion, Albert Rabiteau, and the environmental and caste disparities of American society. Her central concern is how to parent responsibly in perilous times, when the earth is warming, the country is divided, and even the grown-ups feel lost and afraid. What does it mean to survive in the midst of protracted crises, to continually renegotiate threats against life, to cope, she asks, building to the haunting question that drove her to write her book: will my children be all right when I'm gone? At her baby shower, she receives a handcrafted quilt as a present from her mother. The quilt, which features an iconic American log cabin design, becomes a recurring motif as Rabiteau dwells on the need for home, the love of home, and the impermanence of home, highlighting the plight of climate refugees and noting that many Americans will one day fall within that category. She also draws on the quilt to shape her book's artful structure, stitching her essays together according to the log cabin pattern, which joins disparate horizontal and vertical bands of cloth into a harmonious whole. Juxtaposing images of death and life, despair and hope, Rabiteau insists that even as we face a world that is changing faster than we can, we must continue to care for one another and to embrace everyday joys. As she shares her experiences as a writer, mother, and Black New York City resident, she skillfully interweaves observations by friends, scholars, and literary figures like Emily Dickinson and Toni Morrison with grim climate data and social science findings. In her first essay, The Lovely Spark Bird, Rabiteau traces a trail of painted birds across Upper Manhattan, part of a National Audubon Society project to raise awareness of endangered species, discovering that they lift her mood. The first mural she notices, which she calls My Spark, bird lingo for the bird that prompts a casual viewer to become an avid birdwatcher, depicts a pair of burrowing owls, suggesting associations with wisdom and death, and, in the case of this species, a protective dwelling place. The owls poignantly embody her book's themes. Elsewhere, Rabiteau reports on trips to Israel and Palestine, where she learns about the local water crisis, exacerbated by political conflict, and to a Yupik community in coastal Alaska, where she interviews village elders about environmental changes they've witnessed. Yet another essay, a climate diary she kept over the course of a year, consists of comments around the dinner table by friends anxious about erosion, flooding, wildfires, hurricanes, cyclones, sandstorms, toxic algae blooms, drought, desertification, arable land loss, heat waves, locust swarms, and more. If her obvious subjects are loss, survival, and resilience, A quieter but no less important one is the life-sustaining act of sharing our burdens. Her final essay, The Lyrical Dream House and the Pond, is an allegory for our age. Here, Rabiteau describes how she and her spouse purchased their first home in the Bronx, only to discover that it was built on wetland. After losing a battle with the water that pools in front of the house, Rabiteau learns to accept and respect it. The pond is the paved-over wetland reasserting its form. It transcends the mirage of the house, she writes. In this house, vulnerable to the elements as the climate deteriorates, Rabiteau has many beloved things, her father's desk, her backyard garden produce, and her family. All are threatened by the multiple crises outside her door. Nevertheless, on the final page of her book, she returns to the comforting quilt motif inspired by her mother's gift. Our land is a quilt, and our house is only a structure, among pollinating plants visited by bees. Perspective can be a saving grace. While Rabiteau grapples with much that is wrong with our troubled world, she does so with bracing honesty and insight. The strength of her book is her willingness to express concerns that many feel but are reluctant to voice. Realizing that she cannot protect her children from environmental and social changes already underway, she faces into the headwinds of that parental pain, singing her sons lullabies as they fret about superstorms flooding the subways, and teaching them the names of birds despite knowing how many are critically endangered. As Rabiteau studies a photograph of her sons dressed in fearsome Halloween costumes, she reflects, "My young look strong and alert. Good. They will have to be brave for the road work ahead." This review was written by Tia Miles. She is a professor of history at Harvard and the National Book Award-winning author of All That She Carried. Her new book, Night Flyer, Harriet Tubman, and The Faith Dreams of a Free People, will be published in June. The Divorcees by Rowan Baird. My grandmother, who was born in Kobe in 1916, married in Calcutta and raised two children in the post-war London suburbs, used to tell me that the 1920s and 1930s were a wonderful time to be a woman. Then the 50s came, she would continue, indignant, and it's as if they fell asleep. After years of World War II resistance dramas, the American mid-century is back in literary style. Readers are devouring tales of loutish men and unhappy housewives, their wits benumbed by barbiturates and the patriarchy, until some cutting-edge feminist messiah appears to teach them lessons in chemistry. Not all housewives wait around for emancipation, however. In Rowan Baird's debut novel, The Divorcees, a few plucky, well-heeled dames gather in Reno, Nevada, to rusticate at the Golden Yarrow Ranch for 6 weeks, the length of time required to establish Nevada residency and file for divorce. As settings go, a Reno divorce ranch poses certain challenges. The marriage breakup lies behind. The new life beckons ahead. What's a character to do in the meantime? Indeed, when Lois Gorski Saunders arrives at the Golden Yarrow from Lake Forest, Michigan, she doesn't bring much in the way of plans other than a future unshackled from the prospect of children with her awful husband, Lawrence. "Girls don't usually come here because they have not awful husbands," points out one of the ranch's chaperones. The socially awkward Lois avoids the morning horseback rides and the nightly expeditions to the local watering hole. At mealtimes, she spins elaborate lies to obscure both her Polish background and her father's meatpacking fortune from her supercilious fellow guests, who, still stuck in the habits of bourgeois marriage, trudge through the daily routine of shopping and gossip in search of something to shake them up. Enter Greer Lang in a taxi in the middle of the night, just in the nick of time. She's everything you'd expect from a woman named Greer, circa 1950, all button-down shirts and tailored trousers and sass. She flaunts a shiner on her face and a properly mysterious past, and she prods the Golden Yarrow's ladies-in-waiting into acts of increasingly daring mischief, fueled by increasing rounds of cocktails. Her smile widens with every escalation. The nip bottle of champagne, the tangle of maraschino cherry stems Lois slips into a man's chest pocket. Lois is spellbound. When they're together, Lois feels like herself, like the person she wants to be. Naturally, Greer is spinning a few lies of her own. Disciples of brisk prose may grow impatient with Baird's participle-rich structures and her penchant for simile, but the abundance of descriptive detail brings alive both the divorcees and the desert landscape in which they're mired. Lois plays moments from the night before in the reel of her head, in the same way she imagines favorite scenes from films, the appreciative rise of Bailey's eyebrows when Lois's pool balls rolled into the net sockets, Dorothy stumbling toward her with two glasses of gin, Greer handing Lois her lit cigarette, smoke unfurling from her mouth like a swath of silk. The cadence picks up as the hijinks spiral toward a conclusion that a Lois less prone to self-delusion might have seen coming. But that's what halfway houses are for, to learn how to live on the outside again. In Baird's painstakingly constructed world, there are no decent men or decent marriages, and you'd best not rely on the other women either. Even the Messiah has feet of clay, a point my grandmother would have approved. It's up to Lois to save herself, which is either refreshing or heartbreaking, depending on your view of human relations. This review was written by Beatrice Williams, whose latest novel is The Beach at Summerlee. One Way Back, a memoir by Christine Blasey Ford. Indelible in the hippocampus is the laughter. It sounded like a piece of refrigerator poetry suddenly ringing out in the wood-paneled Hart Senate office building. Christine Blasey Ford's distinctive phrase describing her memory of being assaulted at 15 by Brett Kavanaugh, 2 years older, while his friend watched. Kavanaugh, seeking confirmation to the Supreme Court, less poetically but categorically and unequivocally denied he had done any such thing, brandishing old calendars as an alibi. Published more than 5 years after her 2018 congressional testimony, Blasey Ford's new memoir, One Way Back, is an important entry into the public record, but a prosaic one, elusive if belated retort to Senator Chuck Grassley's 414-page maddening memo on the investigation. A big book like this has become the final step in the dizzying, if wearily familiar, passage through the American media ringer, once called a spin cycle, now more like a clown car going through the wash tunnel. Blasey Ford is a research psychologist, professor, and devotee of surfing, who leans heavily on the sport as a metaphor for her ordeal. "You made me paddle out," she tells her lawyers at one point, when they are advising her not to testify after weeks of preparation. "And you never, ever paddle back in once you're out there. You catch the wave. You wipe out if you have to." She explains the difference between a beach break, a quick, rough ride, and a point break, slow, unfurling, and offers deep thoughts on kelp, the marine organism that can be both nuisance and nurturer to humans in the swells. "The same thing that can move you back can also move you forward. I just have to hope for high tide." Coloring the underside of her hair blue to mark summer vacations from her teaching job, Blasey Ford even unwittingly presaged Mermaid Corps. One Way Back, that is, to some sort of shore, is a story of swimming away from the Eastern power establishment and then being sucked inexorably anew into its undertow. Living in country clubbish suburban Washington, D.C., but lacking college degrees, Blasey Ford's parents vowed to give their three children premium educations. Christine, the youngest, attended the all-girls Holton Arms in Bethesda, in social circles concentric with Kavanaugh, a student at the all-boys Georgetown Prep. She enjoyed reading The Great Gatsby as commentary on her circumstances, but even more, Mutiny on the Bounty, which vividly rendered escape from a clear social hierarchy. It was, she writes, the height of an early 80s John Hughes era that glamorized a hypersexualized, debauched high school party scene as depicted in movies like The Breakfast Club and 16 Candles. And it was in such a boys-will-be-boys milieu that she tells of being attacked, with no apparent avenue for recourse. The assailant's suffocating hand over her mouth, attempting to mute her screams, is one terrible detail that lingers, along with the bathing suit under her clothes that impeded their forcible removal. Perhaps it's kind of like my armor, she writes of continuing to layer like this in her adult summers. Blasey Ford never wavers from her certainty that it was the young Kavanaugh looming over her in that room, but she doesn't seem hell-bent on bringing him down. As she mulled going public, if he'd come to me, really leveled with me, and said, I don't remember this happening, but it might have, and I'm so sorry, it might have been a significant therapeutic moment for survivors in general, she writes. I might have wobbled a bit. I might have thought, you know, he was a jackass in high school, but now he's not. Reading this narrative crowded with teams, high-powered lawyers, politicians, public relations people, and, yes, journalists, including a couple from this news organization, one indeed longs for and is denied such a quiet, human, adult scene of confrontation and forgiveness. One also longs for more about Mark Judge, the buddy of Kavanaugh's, who Blasey Ford said was in the room that fateful night. He remained elusive in the proceedings, despite talk of a subpoena, publishing The Devil's Triangle, Mark Judge versus the New American Stasi, in 2022. Instead, we got a noisy, sped-up sequel to the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas saga, with a similar conclusion, a man on the Supreme Court changing the law of the land, a woman from his past consigned to historical footnote. Blasey Ford suffered from her testimony, forced to sequester in hotel rooms with her family, guarded by expensive security. After it's over, there's prolonged PTSD, hunkering down under a fuzzy gray blanket, unable for a while to return to her regular professional life. 25 years does a lot, Hill tells her, about getting back to normal. It felt like a sentencing, Blasey Ford writes of her moment in the floodlights. I suppose this book is my way of breaking free, she muses, yet the publicity for it will, of course, invite more abuse. There are some perks from being in the public eye. Blasey Ford is served bisque by Laureen Power Jobs, sleeps over at Oprah Winfrey's house, goes backstage at a Metallica concert. Her sons get the actual shirt off Steph Curry's back at a Golden Gate Warriors game. Vicious and violent hate mail is outweighed by letters from supporters and fellow survivors piling up on her dining room table, and Blasey Ford expects to donate them to an archive or museum. She used to dive at the pool. Now she has a figurative platform to use when she chooses. There are grants in her name at prestigious institutions. Blasey Ford is incredibly forgiving of her old-school Republican father, who seems to value propriety over defending his daughter's experience, including, ouch, cordially emailing Kavanaugh's dad after the confirmation. She slips in, double ouch, that her older brothers haven't been much in touch since this all happened. Though her signature phrase was mined for a McSweeney's anthology of Me Too writings, Blasey Ford is not a poet, after all, but a scientist, and the mess of fact and fiction about her case rankled on a cellular level. I could see it, the riptide where the truth and narrative were mixing, creating a building current, she writes, persisting with the ocean conceit. Overnight, the small but noticeable divide between truth and news turned into a gulf. To her credit, you never really feel you're drowning, reading One Way Back. But boy, do you long for a nice hot shower afterward. This review was written by Alexandra Jacobs. She joined The Times in 2010. Jaded by Ella Lee. In the middle of Ella Lee's smart, compulsively readable debut novel, Jaded, a human resources employee assures a young lawyer named Jade, "As you know, we take all allegations of sexual misconduct very seriously." They're familiar words, but what do they mean in practice? Has the #MeToo movement changed anything? Jaded explores one millennial's experience as she finds out the hard way. Jade is living the dream. She's the only child of a Korean mother and an Anatolian father, and she has secured a job at the big London law firm Rubin, Fleischer & Wishaw, LLP. But when she wakes up after a work party, hungover, naked, bruised, and bleeding, her life is shattered. Gradually, Jade remembers snippets of the night. She was encouraged to drink by a predatory partner at her firm. A coworker saw that she was in trouble and escorted her home. She let him into her apartment, blacked out, and then this supposedly good Samaritan raped her. After the assault, Jade tries to keep moving, working feverishly, although she suffers from nightmares. But the people around her, like her friend Adele, notice something is amiss. And as Jade tries to disappear into her work, her handsome, white, privileged boyfriend, Kit, complains, "It's getting really rubbish not seeing you for a fortnight at a time." But Jade keeps slogging, telling herself, "It's fine, it's fine, it's fine." The book balances the heavy subject of rape with a darkly funny treatment of work culture. Jade's firm is a place where dining al desco is in vogue. Drafted for the diversity committee, Jade endures meetings where she and her colleagues go around the room and think about how we are personally complicit in upholding oppressive structures. However, when Jade begins to face what happened to her, the novel deepens. Cant about oppressive structures no longer seems absurd. The corporate hope that you feel the office is a safe environment rings hollow. By the same token, when Jade tells Kit what she has been grappling with, the tenor of their relationship changes. Perhaps the finest exchanges in this book are those in which Jade and Kit discuss the night she can't remember. Kit's response to Jade's ordeal is a masterpiece of mixed emotions. He is at once confused, "I don't know what to say," jealous, "The idea of him being intimate with you," sympathetic, "I want to be there for you," and self-pitying, "I don't know why you didn't feel you could tell me." Will justice be served? And how much will Jade risk in its pursuit? These questions drive the plot, but it's the characters who make us care. Lee develops Jade's parents with specificity and tenderness. Her baba in the blue-gray fleece he wears daily from September to March. Her oma serving kimchi jjigae. Jade fears that explaining what happened and admitting that she might need to leave the firm would devastate her mother and father, immigrants who struggled for years to provide for their only child. The misogyny at Jay's law firm is pervasive and soul-sucking. Among the invisible rules for women at social events, Jade notes, is the directive that you should be seductive but don't actually seduce anyone. The stated decree at the firm is that there is a zero-tolerance policy for any behavior that is sexually inappropriate. But as Jade learns, theory and practice diverge. Beneath that rule is a deeper one. If anything happens to you, you should suck it up or leave. There is a big divide between the letter and the spirit of the law. Mind the gap, the London Tube caution goes. That also seems to be the project of Lee's book, minding the gap between talk about versus the reality of sexual misconduct. With Jaded, Lee shows how treacherous that distance can be. This review was written by Allegra Goodman. Her books include Sam, The Chalk Artist, The Cookbook Collector, and Intuition. Dinners with Ruth by Nina Totenberg. In 1971, a call between a reporter and a law professor turned into a friendship that would last 5 decades. Totenberg, who later broke the news of Anita Hill's allegations, recounts a life of mutual support with Ruth Bader Ginsburg through the highs and lows of their trailblazing careers and lives. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.